Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On February 20th, 2008, the court decided LaRue v. DeWolf, holding that although Section 502A2 of ERISA does not provide a remedy for individual injuries distinct from plan injuries, it does authorize recovery for fiduciary breaches that impair the value of plan assets in a participant's individual account. On February 26, 2008, in Sprint United Management Co. v. Mendelson, an employment discrimination case involving the admissibility of testimony by non-plaintiff employees regarding the conduct of other superiors not alleged to have engaged in discriminatory behavior toward the plaintiff, the court ruled that when the Tenth Circuit ruled that the district court had erred in excluding this evidence, the Court of Appeals itself erred in concluding that the district court applied a per se rule and thus improperly engaged in its own analysis of the relevant factors under Rules 401 and 403, rather than remanding the case for the district court to clarify its ruling. Shay Dvoretsky of Jones Day discusses these two employment law decisions. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Dvoretsky.
My name is Shay Dvoretsky. I'm a lawyer with Jones Day in Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court has shown a lot of interest this term in labor and employment cases. Two of those cases are LaRue v. DeWolf, Boberg & Associates, which involves whether ERISA authorizes a lawsuit by a 401k participant for breach of fiduciary duty, and Sprint v. Mendelson, which concerns the admissibility in an individual disparate treatment case under the ADEA of so-called Me Too testimony, that is, testimony by employees other than the plaintiff who claim that they were discriminated against by different supervisors in the organization. Turning to the LaRue case first, an employee, James LaRue, asked his employer to make certain changes to the way in which his 401k funds were invested. He wanted to buy one mutual fund and sell another. For some reason, that change was never made, and 2 years later, Mr. LaRue sued his employer for about $150,000 in lost profits. The district court dismissed Mr. LaRue's complaint, and the Fourth Circuit affirmed. Mr. LaRue argued that two provisions of ERISA authorized his claim, Sections 502A2 and 502A3. Section 502A2 allows recovery of losses to the plan that result from breaches of fiduciary duty. Mr. LaRue argued that the plan itself is just a collection of individual accounts, so the loss to his individual account was a loss to the plan. The employer argued that the statute requires a collective injury, and that Mr. LaRue can't recover for a breach of fiduciary duty that affected only one participant. The Fourth Circuit agreed with the employer, relying also on a Supreme Court case called Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance Company v. Russell, in which the court, in dicta, described Section 502A2 as allowing recovery for losses to the entire plan and to the plan as a whole. The other provision on which Mr. LaRue relied, Section 502A3, authorizes a plaintiff to seek appropriate equitable relief. Mr. LaRue said he was seeking the equitable remedy of surcharge, which he described as a doctrine in equity that allowed recovery for breaches of a trustee's duties. The Fourth Circuit rejected that argument and held that Mr. LaRue was seeking nothing more than monetary damages in the legal sense. The Supreme Court reversed the Fourth Circuit and held that Section 502A2 of ERISA authorizes recovery for fiduciary breaches that impair the value of plan assets in a 401k participant's individual account. Because the Supreme Court decided the case on 502A2 grounds, it did not reach the 502A3 question that the Fourth Circuit had decided against Mr. LaRue. Justice Stevens, who also wrote Russell, wrote the majority opinion in LaRue. The majority focused on explaining the language in Russell about protecting the entire plan. The court said that when Russell was decided, defined benefit plans, that is, traditional pension plans, were predominant. In that context, a fiduciary breach could affect an individual's entitlement to benefits only if it threatened the solvency of the entire plan. Now, Justice Stevens wrote, the pension landscape has changed because defined contribution plans like 401k plans predominate. In a 401k plan, fiduciary misconduct doesn't have to threaten the solvency of the entire plan to reduce an individual participant's benefits below the amount that he would otherwise have received. Since the purpose of Section 502A2, Justice Stevens wrote, is to ensure that the benefits authorized by the plan are ultimately paid to participants, ERISA authorizes a claim for fiduciary misconduct that affects even one 401k participant's benefits. The court concluded that the references in Russell to the entire plan accurately reflected the nature of a fiduciary breach in the defined benefit context, but are beside the point given the shift in the pension plan market to 401k plans. Although the result in LaRue was unanimous, four justices did not join Justice Stevens' opinion. Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Justice Kennedy, concurred in the judgment and suggested that Mr. LaRue's claim was not properly viewed as a fiduciary breach claim at all, but rather as a claim for benefits. Such a claim may be more appropriately brought under Section 502A1B of ERISA, which allows a participant to recover benefits due to him under the terms of the plan. And if a claim may be brought under Section 502A1B, that may be exclusive of bringing a claim under Section 502A2 as well. The distinction between a 502A1B claim and a 502A2 claim, Chief Justice Roberts explained, may be quite significant, because Section 502A1B claims for benefits are subject to an administrative exhaustion requirement, followed by judicial review for abuse of discretion if the plan gives plan administrators discretion in determining benefit eligibility and the meaning of plan terms. Chief Justice Roberts did not believe that the court was in a position to definitively resolve these questions in LaRue because Mr. LaRue had not sought relief under Section 502A1B, and the lower courts had not addressed that provision. But the Chief Justice made clear that, in his view, nothing in the majority's opinion precluded lower courts from considering the availability of relief under Section 502A1B in circumstances like Mr. LaRue's, and from considering whether that availability would preclude relief for fiduciary breach under Section 502A2. Finally, Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Scalia, concurred in the judgment to express his view that the statutory text authorized Mr. LaRue's claims. Because the assets allocated to Mr. LaRue's individual account were plan assets, a loss to his account, in Justice Thomas's view, is a loss to the plan and is recoverable under Section 502A2. A few thoughts on the opinions in LaRue. First, as a jurisprudential matter, Justice Stevens's majority opinion seems quite odd. The relevant framework for assessing Mr. LaRue's claim has to be the statutory text. Justice Stevens' opinion never really analyzes the actual words of the statute. It instead tries to ascertain the concerns of ERISA's drafters and the trends in the pension plan market that may or may not make dicta from Russell less relevant in a new context. The sort of common law approach to decision-making in Justice Stevens' opinion, perhaps driven by a desire to rationalize the dicta in Russell, seems wholly out of place in a statutory case like this, particularly given the court's insistence in other cases on a close textual analysis of ERISA. Second, this case is important both for private parties and for the courts. For private parties, LaRue allocates the risk of administrative errors in connection with 401k plans. By recognizing an individual 401k participant's claim for breach of fiduciary duty, the Supreme Court's decision has at least the potential to increase the cost to employers of providing 401k plans. From the perspective of judicial economy, LaRue creates the potential to overload courts with federal lawsuits over benefit denials or administrative errors without first requiring participants to attempt to pursue their rights through an administrative review process. These concerns may have animated Chief Justice Roberts' concurrence in the judgment, in which he invited defendants to argue and lower courts to consider whether claims like Mr. LaRue's need to be brought under Section 502A1B, which carries with it an administrative exhaustion requirement. Moreover, the majority opinion in footnote 3 expressly left open the possibility that a plaintiff like Mr. LaRue might need to exhaust administrative remedies before bringing a claim under Section 502A2 as well. These issues will likely be resolved in further litigation. Third, we don't know on the limited record of this case why the change that Mr. LaRue requested wasn't made, or why he took 2 years to sue. A plaintiff in Mr. LaRue's shoes might purposely wait until well into the limitations period before suing in order to see how the market performs, and whether he would be better off with the mix of investments that he actually has, or with the lost profits for the investments he requested. Nothing in the LaRue opinion prevents employers from asserting a laches defense against that sort of abuse. In fact, the court, again in footnote 3, expressly said that it was not deciding any question of timeliness. As for the Sprint case, the plaintiff, Ellen Mendelson, was laid off by Sprint in 2002. In response to economic conditions in the telecommunications industry, Sprint reduced its payroll by about 15,000 employees. Ms. Mendelson, who at the time was 51 years old, claimed that she was chosen for layoff because of her age. Before trial, Sprint filed a motion in limine to exclude the proposed testimony of 5 former Sprint employees who claimed that they, too, were discriminated against based on age in layoffs that were conducted in other departments by other managers within about a year of Ms. Mendelson's layoff, and as part of the same overall reduction in force. Sprint argued that this so-called Me Too evidence about alleged discrimination by other supervisors was irrelevant under Federal Rule of Evidence 401 because it didn't shed light on the motives of Ms. Mendelson's supervisor in selecting her for layoff. Sprint also argued that the testimony should, in any event, be excluded as prejudicial, confusing, and unnecessary under Federal Rule of Evidence 403. The district court granted Sprint's motion, but did not make clear whether its ruling was a relevance determination under Rule 401 or the result of balancing under Rule 403. The jury found in favor of Sprint. The Tenth Circuit reversed in a 2-1 decision, concluding that the district court had abused its discretion in excluding the testimony of these 5 witnesses. The Tenth Circuit held that this evidence was relevant under Rule 401 as proof of a company-wide policy of discrimination in connection with the reduction in force. The Tenth Circuit further held that the district court had no discretion to exclude this evidence under Rule 403. The upshot of the Tenth Circuit's view is that, in an employment discrimination case, all testimony of employees other than the plaintiff who claim to have suffered the same sort of bias against them, even if they worked for a different supervisor or in a different work unit than the plaintiff, is per se admissible. Sprint's principal argument before the Supreme Court was that the evidence in question was not relevant under Rule 401. Sprint argued that in an individual disparate treatment case, liability can only be established through evidence of discriminatory intent by the person who made the relevant employment decision. Here, Sprint argued, the Me Too testimony was irrelevant because the witnesses had no information suggesting that Ms. Mendelson's supervisor discriminated against her. Sprint argued as a fallback that the evidence was properly excluded under Rule 403 because it was prejudicial and would have caused undue delay stemming from many trials into the circumstances of the individual witnesses. Ms. Mendelson argued before the Supreme Court that plaintiffs have no choice but to rely on the circumstantial evidence provided by Me Too witnesses because direct evidence of discrimination is so hard to come by. She argued that this testimony is relevant because it shows a culture or atmosphere of discrimination at the company, to which Sprint responded that the testimony of 5 employees out of tens of thousands in the organization doesn't constitute a culture. Ms. Mendelson minimized any concern about prejudice or delay, which she said could be handled by jury instructions and proper case management by the district court. The Solicitor General weighed in and agreed with Ms. Mendelson that evidence of discrimination against other employees may be relevant depending on the plaintiff's theory of the case. But the SG disagreed with the Tenth Circuit that such evidence is per se admissible under Rule 403. The Solicitor General urged the Supreme Court to remand the case so that the District Court could expressly conduct the balancing called for by Rule 403. For the most part, the Supreme Court's opinion sidestepped the substantive issues about what establishes a defendant's liability in an individual disparate treatment discrimination case. The opinion turned instead on the proper role of trial courts versus appellate courts in applying the federal rules of evidence. Writing for a unanimous court, Justice Thomas explained that, contrary to how the Tenth Circuit interpreted the district court's order, it was not clear that the district court applied a rule of per se inadmissibility to Me Too evidence. In fact, it was not clear whether the basis for the district court's 2-sentence order was Rule 401, Rule 403, or both. Given the deference that a court of appeals ordinarily owes to a trial court's evidentiary rulings, the Tenth Circuit should have remanded the case for the district court to clarify the basis for its order. The Supreme Court criticized the Tenth Circuit for instead engaging in its own balancing under Rule 403. As Justice Thomas explained, the district court is virtually always in the better position to assess relevance and prejudice in the context of the facts and arguments before it. The Supreme Court's decision provided little guidance about how a district court should conduct that analysis, noting simply that Me Too evidence is neither per se admissible nor per se inadmissible in all circumstances. As for the implications of the Supreme Court's decision, first, this turned out to be a case largely about the federal rules of evidence rather than substantive employment law. Litigants and courts will no doubt cite it for the broad discretion that trial courts have as gatekeepers regarding relevance and prejudice questions. The opinion may also support the more liberal use of remands by appellate courts for district courts to clarify ambiguous evidentiary rulings, instead of an appellate reversal based on an uncertain reading of what the district court meant. On the substantive anti-discrimination issues in this case, the Supreme Court didn't provide any bright line settling the question of the admissibility of Me Too evidence. Plaintiff's lawyers may seize on dicta in Justice Thomas's opinion that it would be erroneous to apply a per se rule of inadmissibility to Me Too evidence in all circumstances. But that dicta was grounded in a general aversion to per se rules about relevance under Rule 401, not in a substantive determination that Me Too evidence is in fact relevant to establishing liability under the ADEA or any other anti-discrimination statute. And this case may well favor employers in the long run, because it clearly gives district courts the discretion to exclude Me Too evidence under Rule 403. Given the potential of Me Too evidence to prejudice the jury and to lead to lengthy trials over the circumstances of the Me Too witnesses rather than the plaintiff, many district courts may well act on that discretion to exclude.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.